Retina Rounds, podcast number 28. Today we're diving into one of the most transformative forces in modern medicine, artificial intelligence. How will AI change the way ophthalmic care is delivered? What new possibilities and challenges will it bring to the clinic and beyond? To unpack these questions, Retina Rounds is honored to welcome Dr. Theodore Leng, Professor of Ophthalmology, Director of Clinical and Translational Research, and Medical Informatics Director for Ambulatory Specialties at Stanford University. Dr. Leng is also the co-founder and co-chair of the Ophthalmic Artificial Intelligence Summit. In this episode, Dr. Leng gives us a peek into how artificial intelligence is redefining the future of vision care. Let's check it out.
Welcome, everybody, to Retina Rounds podcast. I'm thrilled and excited to introduce Ted Leng from Stanford University. Ted is not only a leader in vitreoretinal surgery and clinical trials, but he's also a world-renowned AI specialist, and he's published a lot on artificial intelligence in retinal conditions and will be able to afford us some unique perspective on what is clearly the hot topic of the year. So, Ted, thanks for joining us.
So great to be here, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you. Ted, tell us a little bit about your journey. How did you come to ophthalmology?
Well, we can go all the way back to the early days. I grew up in a household with some medical influence. My mom was a midwife, and my dad was an interventional cardiologist. This was back in Newark, New Jersey. Interesting thing, which is kind of crazy now, is he was the only cardiologist at three hospitals in the city of Newark when he first started practicing. I think there's a saying that there used to be one cardiologist for every heart patient out there, and now there's one cardiologist for every heartbeat, is what he used to joke to me about. But, I obviously grew up with an interest in science. And as I was coming up through my schooling, I sought out different opportunities, and I knew I wanted to do something with surgery because that was just my inclination. And as I was growing up, I got glasses. I'm a myope. I got glasses in fourth grade. And fortunately, I saw one of my family friends who was an ophthalmologist, a comprehensive ophthalmologist in New Jersey. And he was very, generous with his time, answered a lot of my questions being a little kid, and just really got me going into that direction. And when I got to Stanford University, for both undergraduate and medical school, eventually I started volunteering in the ophthalmology department, shuttling patients from the clinic to the preoperative area at the main hospital. And when I matriculated in medical school, I was fortunate to have some really amazing mentors. Primary of that was Mark Blumenkrantz, our department chair at the time, a renowned retina specialist in our field and friend to many, and he really took me under his wing and really nurtured my passion for ophthalmology and retina.
Well, I can tell you with perfect authority that Mark is exceptionally proud of you, and you could not have lucked into a better mentor or chosen more wisely. He's a giant in retina, and he's graced this podcast and certainly helped a lot of us make the good decisions in our lives. So kudos to you for that. And so you went to Stanford as an undergrad. What did you study?
I double majored in biological sciences and also philosophy with a specialty in the history and philosophy of science. I think I'm truly a humanity person at heart. So I really enjoyed, reading and thinking deeply about topics and formulating arguments. And so I think that's where my kind of emotional passion lay. But I think ultimately the pragmatic side of me wanted to be in the field of science.
That's fantastic. And so who were the philosophers that influenced you most in those years?
So I think Hume was the kind of biggest one. He talked about scientific revolutions, and so really explored how to analyze historically how knowledge became knowledge, because there was a lot of fits and spurts. There was a lot of argument over whether someone was a heretic or not, and coming up with a new theory of how the universe was aligned and how that eventually became knowledge, and how there's a lot of politicking and probably some unscrupulous behaviors by scientists of old. For example, Galileo became a famous astronomer partially because he hoarded all the telescopes in Italy and wouldn't let other scientists use those telescopes, because he had a sponsor, was a rich person, I think, back in the day. So those were kind of little interesting anecdotes that really, add some color to development of technology and knowledge over time.
It's interesting because a lot of us have been exposed to great philosophers either through our readings or studies or mentorship. And I think back on my journey, I was very lucky to be exposed to John Searle, who became, while I was an undergrad, became interested in the philosophy of the mind and the biology, how the biology and the physiology of the mind interacted with the thought processes and the philosophies. And I remember sharing with him one of my textbooks, which was about the anatomy of the brain, and he was just in physiology of the brain, and he was just absolutely smitten with it. And we became close as a relation as a result of that, and it was very impactful on me. So it's interesting to me that you also had a philosophical background. That's something that I didn't know about you. It feels like, Ted, that we're coming into a fit and start and a revolution in science right now with artificial intelligence. And so give me your perspective, share with with us your perspective on artificial intelligence. You're right in the center of it in Silicon Valley there and at Stanford, and you've worked so much in it. How do you see it shaping our field personally? Like, how do you see it shaping our field?
Well, I think that's a really big question, Steve.
Enormous.
AI has been around for a long time. People sometimes don't realize that it was conceived, I think, at Dartmouth College back in the 50s. And I think with the technological advancements with processing power, it wasn't until recently. Say 5 to 7 years ago, that we were able to actually capitalize on those theories and make them into reality and really harness the ability for machine and machine algorithms to
So what
really.
you're saying is the guys at Dartmouth maybe weren't heretics?
Probably not. I don't think they were heretics. I think they were just before their time. I think a lot, like a lot of things in technology, there's people who are visionaries and they could conceive of something that wasn't really possible to execute the time of them coming up with those ideas. I think how's it going to impact ophthalmology? I think there's so many different facets about how AI can really impact us. I think it's going to impact the physician-patient relationship, maybe helping us interact with our patients in a probably in a more meaningful way.
Let's drill on that for a second. So how will AI impact the doctor-patient relationship and make it more meaningful?
Well, that's my hope, I would think. I think as much as technology can be cold and distancing at times and in certain ways, my hope is that the technology will actually bring humans more together. So I think, look at a typical clinical encounter we have where we are so pressed for time right now. We just have an unending burden of patients that we're seeing. For retinal diseases, the population is aging, the incidence of age-related eye disease is increasing. And so we are a finite resource. And so I think any ability to offset the care we deliver to possibly an automated technology or an assistive technology like AI could allow us to be more focused on the interaction with the patients. Because I think ultimately, what we do as physicians is actually we are the guides to our patients. At some point someday, the medical decision making is going to be done by a machine, maybe better than what we can do right now, but ultimately that person that we're taking care of is still going to have an emotional response to what we're telling them or what the machine's telling them and what the treatment plan might be. And what they're receiving as treatment, and our role is to actually work with the patient to partner with them and connect with them to ease them into that and help them accept what they're being faced with and help them to process it.
Interesting. And so doctor-patient relationship potentially a plus. How about diagnostics and prognostics?
Well, I think one of the challenges, I think, for retina specifically with AI is that we are pretty good at doing our work right now. I think retina doctors are probably one of the most efficient and effective physicians that exist in the medical system. And so if you're trying to augment the performance of something that's already operating at the 99th percentile efficiency, the bar is really, really high. And so I think for that reason, we haven't seen a lot of AI being integrated into our clinical workflows right now because we're pretty good at what we do. So I think at helping with diagnosis is probably not really a needed area right now for the average retinal physician. I think where augmentive technologies, and we'll call this clinical decision support, where we have an automated machine that can process data either before we see the patient or while we're seeing them, and then suggests to us what we need to do next, is going to help us make our decisions more effectively and hopefully better for the patient and better for the healthcare system. So if we're able to use an AI that can tell us, hey, this patient is not doing so well in the treatment course that we're giving them, you're giving them drug X, and they've gotten two or three of those, and it doesn't seem to be working. The AI could tell us, well, maybe we should switch to drug Y, which will be both more effective and more cost effective for the patient in the healthcare system. So I think, a lot of what we do is we're using algorithms in person right now. We use, one treatment, give it a few tries. If it doesn't work, we switch to a different treatment. Maybe with a powerful enough AI, we can choose the right treatment the first time for the patient, so we don't have to switch. Or if they're on something that's not working quite right, we can get them onto something that will work better for them.
Well, how about something just as simple as detecting the presence or absence of fluid? I know you look at every single cut of every single OCT before you make a treatment decision, but not everybody does that. And there are those who rely on a map or rely on a few representative cuts or have their own algorithm for how they evaluate an OCT. Would a tighter algorithm that, allowed an AI to determine the presence or absence of fluid or an increase or de decrease in fluid that didn't require a lot of physician time and was physician-facing be of value?
Absolutely. I think that goes into the practice of medicine as well. I think there's a term you can call a cognitive load or something, or fatigue. We work really hard all day, and at the end of the day, you're exhausted. So if you don't have to scan through whatever you're doing, 128 or 200 scans per cube, and the machine could flag three scans where there's new fluid, and then you could look at those three scans and confirm that there is new fluid, then you don't, you're going to save yourself both time and the cognitive load of doing that analysis. So yeah, I think a tool like that where all the our data is pre-processed for us and then only the relevant information is presented to us would be very, very helpful.
I agree with you. And go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I've also had a lot of experience in the aviation industry since I was a teenager. And when you're designing systems for pilots, there's kind of this thing we call the dark cockpit concept, where in the very critical phases of flight, only critical information is presented to the pilot, so they're not distracted or overloaded when they're doing other high attention tasks. For example, if you're taking an airplane off, maybe you don't want to know that the light bulb just burned out in the back seat. But maybe if you're in the cruise flight, that'd be something you would get indication for. So similarly, presenting the ophthalmologist with just the critical information at the time that's needed, is a concept that we can take from that industry and apply it to our field.
Fascinating. I want to come back to the aviation example when we, excuse me, talk about AI and surgery. But for now, let's talk about prognosis. So we've seen AMD risk scores or DR risk, diabetic retinopathy risk scores, but we've not, they're all pretty complicated and they require a fair amount of cognitive work and a lot of time. And there have been a lot of good attempts to simplify them for us and for our patients. But when we start to combine the complexities of genetics, phenotyping, imaging, family history, whatever, current findings on exam, medical history, do you feel like there will be an AI agent that can help us with prognosis early on? You feel like that's coming where we've all had the patient who's got somebody accompanying them who's a parent with AMD, for example. Am I at risk? And the question is, what's my risk? Are we going to be able to? There's a lot of emphasis on this in the industry right now, particularly in the imaging community, trying to assess this risk or risk of other conditions, dementias or neurologic issues, cardiovascular issues. Even I've seen some people talking about paraneoplastic markers. What are your thoughts around that? Do you think that's near term or the training sets are too far away? What's your thinking?
Oh, absolutely. This is very near term. For example, our research group at Stanford, several years ago, we published a series of papers looking at the prediction from dry AMD to wet AMD, and we used training sets from the Harbor data, Harbor study, and we were able to show with a pretty high level of
Remind our listeners what the Harbor study was.
So the Harbor study was a randomizumab trial, and it was unique specifically for what our purposes and any other data scientists out there because it was the first wet AMD trial to use spectral domain OCT data. Before then, the Anchor Marina and all those coming forward, we only had time domain OCT. It's kind of crazy to think about that now, but it was the first data set to have.
You're too young to remember the days before OCT.
Spectral domain data. It also had genetic data. One of the interesting things about that trial also, they looked at different doses of medicines. I remember, I think it was a 2 milligram dose and a 0.5 milligram dose, but that's not really relevant for our purposes here. But what we did is we asked the sponsor, which was Genentech, to use that data set, not to look at the eyes that were actually enrolled in a trial, but look at the fellow eyes, the dry AMD eyes. And follow them over time to see if we can identify OCT biomarkers for prediction and progression to neovascular AMD. And I think our initial goal back at that time was to really augment what we had, which was the AREDS study. AREDS study, you mentioned the risk score. The risk scores for the AREDS study are great. You have a simplified severity scale, which I use in my clinical practice on a daily basis. But that gives you a 5 and 10 year risk score of progression to advanced AMD. What the patient in your room wants to know is, well, hey, doc, what's going to happen to me next year, 6 months from now, not 10 years from now?
Or is there anything that I can do to reduce that score, that risk, or any increased surveillance or lifestyle changes, or so how you feel like that's near term with AI?
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, even with our, we'll call it relatively rudimentary regression analysis we did at the time, and this is without AI, we were able to show that we could, predict the progression of AMD within 6 months based on just the OCT data. And now you're mentioning, bringing in other serologic biomarkers, demographic factors, other things like that into creating a more holistic risk score. I think the ability to predict someone's progression in the near term is going to be much greater. And then, more importantly, once you do intervene with any sort of modifications, whether they be supplements or therapeutic, FDA-approved therapeutics or other things, maybe a light therapy, showing the change in those risk calculations over time, I think will be really impactful for the patients themselves and the doctors that are prescribing or recommending these different therapies. I see very specifically with the The two complement inhibitors we have in the market right now, we have some really powerful algorithms that can predict the rate of growth of geographic atrophy or even just where it's going to go in the next few months. Those algorithms can be used right now today to show a patient, hey, this is where you're going to be if you don't treat anything. And maybe once you start treatment 6 months, 12 months later, show them another map showing this is the new prediction of where your GA is going to go. And if that is different than what the original prediction was, that would be really meaningful, I think, to keep patients engaged and coming in for these regular treatments that are often, obviously painful and time-consuming and just not fun to do, or where they're not seeing any sort of like tangible benefit up front.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Ted. What about AI agents for just business process management in the office? Are you espousing a virtual scribe, for example, an AI scribe? What are you guys doing at Stanford? You're always doing something that we're all going to be doing in 10 years, so let us know.
Well, I think there's a lot of augmentive technologies that we can use in our workflows. So, what we're using right now at Stanford is a an ambient AI that will scribe for us. It takes a pretty decent history of present illness and medical history, previous surgical history. I think
What
the
do you mean it takes
technologies.
it? It actually asks the patient in plain language, audibly, or?
Oh, yeah. Sorry to clarify. No, it listens in on my conversation with the patients, but
Good.
then it writes it down in a very clear manner. And it's really useful for those patients that have a really long, complicated history. If I'm getting a second or third opinion coming in to see me for an eye that's had, 10 surgeries and trauma and other things, and
You
they
mean
want to
like the
know
ones that I send you?
what exactly. All the patients that have moved from Southern California or the desert up to the Bay Area that you've sent me. So, so I think this is kind of like entry level AI, these ambient AIs that can listen in.
And that interfaces with your Epic or Cerner or whatever you're using there.
It does. So right now we're using a Microsoft product, and they have an agreement with Stanford University, and Epic is playing along to allow it to interface and actually, go into the medical record. But in the, in the effort to be as safe as possible for the patients, we're not giving Microsoft's AI much access to the actual patient's current medical record, so that, there's no loss of protected information to the AI agent itself.
Good. That's
And
fascinating.
over time, we're going to have agents that are, it's going to be able to pend orders. So if you talk about, hey, we're going to get an OCT and do a intravitreal injection next visit, it's going to pend those orders for you, and then you just have to sign them. Or if you talk about prescribing an eye drop to lower eye pressure, if they're, a glaucoma suspect, or it's a postoperative patient, the pressure is a little high, it's going to go ahead and, put in that timolol prescription for you, and then you can just sign it. Then there's going to be technologies which will help with billing codes, so your ENM levels, as well as other CPT codes that you're going to be billing during your encounters. That's kind of like the AI for the physician. But then there's, like you mentioned, back office. So there's going to be a whole.
Well, stay on the physician for a second. So,
Okay,
is
sure.
it scribing for you also, like through the exam?
It is, yeah. So I would say that's one area where it's not working that great. And I think, to be fair, this particular software wasn't designed for ophthalmologists in mind. So I fully expect that there will be an ophthalmology focused AI scribe program that's going to do an excellent job. But right now, you would have to kind of go through the different parts of the eye and say, well, the cornea looks clear on the right and the left, and the nerve is pink, and the cup to disc ratio is this and that. And whatever you don't mention, it kind of leaves out. And so it's kind of an artificial and an awkward, encounter with the patient, because they're not used to having you verbalize every
Well,
aspect
but
of
that's
their
not
eye.
altogether different than having a human scribe in the room. I mean,
True, but the
look.
human also knows that if you don't mention that the iris is doesn't have a nevus or a PI, they just mark it as normal, right? So I think over time the AI will be able
Default to
to
normal.
interpolate that from the conversation as well.
Yeah, we always just said standard instead of not saying anything. So that our patients were so picky that they would, well, what about my cornea? So that's interesting. So take us through the back office functionality of the AI agents that you're familiar with.
Well, I think this is where there's a lot of room for innovation, and I think as physicians, we often don't understand the pain points of the back office. That could be anything from scheduling to handling patient calls for a slew of problems, whether it's medication refill, making new appointments, canceling appointments, rescheduling appointments. There's also pre-authorization for the very expensive medications we have in our offices, where if you don't get reimbursed for a treatment you're giving, you're just losing thousands of dollars at that day. So I think there I've talked to some companies that are creating artificial intelligence workflows where they're helping to get those pre-authorizations in place and helping what does amount to a lot of man hours of time for the staff to get all these authorizations in place before you and I can actually just see a patient and take care of them.
It's interesting. I'm wondering whether these functionalities will become so ubiquitous that they are almost like the flashlight on your phone. Like the innovation right now is motivational for these ventures, but I'm wondering whether they'll become so widespread that it's almost not a business after a while. It's
Yeah,
a
I mean,
worry.
it's actually really interesting too, because a lot of these AI companies and technologies, they'll have one really cool product, right? Something that gets your pre-authorizations for you, or something that helps you with scheduling. But ultimately, everything's going to have to collapse and coalesce into one company or product, because you can't go out there and buy a software license for 50 things in your office. You only want to get a license for one or two products, right? So there's going to be a certain consolidation that's going to happen at some point.
And are you foreseeing that coming from the EHR companies or from the AI companies that will envelop the EHR companies? How do you see it?
I see it happening in both directions, actually. I think the big EHR companies are either internally developing these technologies, or they're acquiring the smaller companies with kind of the piecemeal algorithms. But then I also know of some really ambitious AI companies which are trying to create their own EHRs, and you and I both know how difficult that's going to be to break into that market. But
It's a highly fragmented market, for sure.
they're still going to try to take that shot for sure.
It's great that they're doing it, and I'm rooting for all of them. One of the things I look forward to is having an AI agent on our side versus the payers, and then waiting for the payers to get an AI agent, so it'll be sort of spy versus spy, fixed
I think
number of.
the payers are already using AI agents
Of course they are.
deny our claims. So I think we're currently losing that arms race, I think.
Yeah,
But
the
I think
payers are pretty sophisticated.
we are we've piloted some algorithms actually at our university level to help some AI models to help with payments as well. So there's kind of like a likelihood of payment model that is running in the background. We haven't actually turned it on yet, but we're testing these things out. We have models that predict readmission rates and other things like that. So there's some models out there that are being tested right now in on the provider side, I would say,
I
on
should
the
mention
hospital
to our
system side.
listeners two things. For our international listeners, we will get off the American domestic payer and back office discussion pretty rapidly. But for everybody, Ted is not just a retinal and AI guru. He's also on the Stanford, fill it in, Ted, it's the Information Technology Committee for the hospital or
Sure. Yeah,
what?
I'm a medical informatics director at for the hospital system, and I'm in charge of all of ambulatory specialties. So anyone that sees a patient in an outpatient clinic, I kind of represent their interests to the larger hospital org. And so I work directly under the chief medical information officer and the chief information officer for Stanford Healthcare.
Which is a remarkable vantage point, and thank you for sharing the perspectives with us. So, getting away from US domestic AI agent facilitation issues and moving back over to generalized retina care, let's move into the OR. What's exciting you about AI in the OR?
Well, I think a lot of the initial innovations are happening on the anterior segment side, to be honest. You can imagine there is AI IOL calculators, for example, and it's helping to kind of streamline that workflow from the clinic into the operating room so you can pick the right lens. Intraoperatively, you're going to have aberrometry, helping you position that lens so that it's really, well in place for them. And they're doing a lot of computer vision as well. So computer vision is a subset of artificial intelligence. It was what your Tesla uses so to hopefully not crash into the car next to it and into any pedestrians you might encounter in Los Angeles. But they're doing a lot of augmented reality overlays, so we can kind of track the limbus, for example, and the iris, and help you overlay, say, like a rexus meter, so you can create that rexus really precisely when you're doing a cataract surgery. On the retina side, we're doing a lot of instrument tip tracking, so you can see if the retractor is getting too close to the retina, and that brings us back to the aviation reference you made earlier, where you're going to get a little warning symbol in your ear, maybe proximity alert that you're getting too close to the retina. Maybe you should pull up and get away from that retina, and other things like being able to visualize retinal tears or hemorrhage on the retina during a case. If you see a tear as you're doing scleral depression on a retinal attachment case, the AI will see it. It'll put a little green box around it so that you can come back to it and not have to find it again. Or if you switch to air, be able to find it again, laser it, which is, as retina surgery is actually quite easy when you can see everything. But a lot of the skill comes when you have a suboptimal view. And we tell that to our.
Visualization and knowing where you are is critical. Situational awareness, one of the favorite things we discuss. Well, Ted Lang, thank you so much for discussing AI with us. Let's swap over and talk a little bit about your fellowship at Stanford. It's one of the great VR fellowships. It's really emerging as a leader. And we've had discussions on Retina Rounds with Ehsan Rahimi, who's next door at the Palo Alto Medical Foundation, I believe, and on your faculty. And your group is just amazing at Stanford, and the fellows are fantastic. They look to you as one of the premier surgical innovators and teachers. So take us through the holistic tips or do's and don'ts when you sit down with a fellow, a retina fellow, for the first week or two of fellowship. What are you telling them to concentrate on, and how do you plot out their learning curve? And then we'll go to the end of fellowship as well.
Well, I think there's two things. I think there's the in the OR planning, but then there's also kind of the career training planning. So, on the second point, I like to have these kind of quarterly reviews with our fellows to go over, their life essentially, like where are they going, where are they heading? Do you have a plan for that? And how can we help you achieve those goals? I think the core philosophies of our program is that we're here to fully support the career development of our fellows, way even beyond the 2 years they spend with us in the clinics in the OR. And so, toward that end, we do have a day a week where they have non-clinical time to pursue other pursuits, whether that's a bench research. We
That's
have had
Sunday.
fellows. In LA, that's Sunday. No, it's actually during the work week. So Monday through Friday, they get one day a week to kind of do what they want. Some fellows book extra cases. Some fellows will work in, pipetting and growing cells, and other fellows will start companies. So we had one fellow here who was a CEO of a startup company, and he spent that day, raising money and going through the FDA process for his device. So, but I think, when we first get a new fellow in the operating room, there's very basic things that we work on, and visualization, I think, is one of those. So just learning how to coordinate your hands and feet, getting the illumination just right, not letting that light pipe drift down towards the retina. So there's a lot of, us in their ear, hey, pull the light pipe back, pull the light pipe back. We don't want it crashing through the retina. Just making sure that they can see what they're doing. And from then, it's a stepwise process to help them learn how to become effective surgeons.
So you and I were discussing the other day one of the teaching points videos you made for how to identify where to peel or how to initiate a peel in a macular pucker. Can you take us through some of those points?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I really enjoy macular surgery, and I think that was like one of the things that my mentor Mark Blumenkrantz enjoyed as well. Like I really learned a lot from him. I think one of the most important things I realized for myself during fellowship was sometimes you can learn more by watching a master at work than by trying to do it yourself. I think a lot of trainees, even when I was a resident, you're like, oh, I just want to do more cases because I'm going to learn better that way. But I think the perfect scenario is you get your hands dirty a few times, you do a handful of cases, then you step back and then you watch someone who's really good at what you were just doing. And I think you have to do those first few cases so you have a context and perspective for which to then apply those observations. How someone actually holds her hands on the surface of the eye. So not even looking through the microscope, but looking outside the microscope, seeing what they're resting their fingers and their wrists and their elbows on. So I think one of the key things that I try to teach our fellows is that when you go down and approach the retina to try to grab that epiretinal membrane or the internally limiting membrane when you're doing a macular hole case, is to pinch the surface, but then release it. Because I think that creates a little wrinkle, a little tag that you can then go back down and re-grasp more easily. And then just to slowly elevate, but not try to translate horizontally. Because I think that's one of the most common mistakes I see with first time surgeons who are doing membrane peeling surgery is they're like, oh, immediately, it's like a rhexis, right? So you get a small rip and then you just kind of, peel along the retina and tear it. But I think one of the main teachings that I learned from Mark Blumenkrantz is you want to extend that rent horizontally for as long as you can. And then once you have a nice flap, then reflect it along the retina. So just getting that initial ridge, creating elevating it and creating a separation between the membrane and the retina surface. And once that blister is big, nice and big, then create your rent. Go back in along that hole and extend it horizontally. And then once you have a nice size thing, you can then peel it. And oftentimes you can get the whole thing up in one piece, which is quite satisfying.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for that, Ted. And that's the reason why Retina Rounds with Dr. Prasad is so useful because it affords the subscribers daily views of masters at work and lots of different perspectives, and hopefully allows people to improve by watching and discussing. Ted, let's circle back to fellowship. You trained your vitreoretinal surgery at Bascom Palmer, one of the great institutions on the face of the earth. And who impacted you there? I mean, I know everybody did, but who really did you gravitate towards? And what have you brought? Tell me a couple of the lessons that you brought forward into your career and who they came from.
Sure, absolutely. So just to clarify, I did my residency at Bascom Palmer, but I did my retina
Excuse
training at
me.
Stanford.
Excuse me. Got that backwards.
So when I was there, it was the heyday of anti-VEGF. I arrived just after the first Avastin injection was given into the eye. So I really was drawn to Phil Rosenfeld for his innovative brain. Essentially, he was very instructive about treating patients and really trained all of us residents at that time on how to administer these anti-VEGF injections. A bunch of very important research projects with him. And from a surgical side, I think I really enjoyed working with Bill Smitty because I feel that one of my goals in surgery is to be as efficient as possible. And you don't often find a retinal surgeon that's running two rooms twice a week. And he would refuse to do anything smaller than 20 gauge because it was too slow. Watching him work and from both fixing retinal attachments and doing macular surgery, I think was really, really, instructive for me.
Yeah, Bill and Phil are both huge, huge role models for all of us. They're thought leaders and huge innovators. Well, what a fortunate perspective to have. And when you, I know you spend a little bit of time with the medical students and trainees before residency and then with the residents. When you're counseling residents on the choices they're making, whether or not to go into retina, what's that conversation like? What are you looking for? What are you helping them with?
I think it's a really interesting thing where we're almost at an inflection point in fellowship selection. I think retina ruled for a long time because of all the cool innovations that we have access to and we're a part of. But I think a lot of the anterior segment surgery is now becoming more interesting to the trainees because they're seeing our retina clinics more as a medical retina view. Like they're seeing, we're just doing these injections and the surgeries are kind of taking a back burner to our practices. And I think that the younger trainees are really excited by the innovative surgery techniques that they're seeing. And so, with all the MIGS and the advanced anterior segment surgeries and the kind of more refractive surgeries that are available now, I think it's attracting a lot of the younger students and trainees into those fields. But I think retina is making a comeback. I think we have so much potential with these gene therapies that are in development, the cell therapies that are in development, and so kind of the regenerative aspects of retina, I think, is going to re-entice those trainees back into the field of retina. And I think when I advise our trainees, I think what I really emphasize is the potential to make a huge impact, right? I think one of the reasons I chose vitreoretinal diseases over other fields of ophthalmology was a lot of the mysteries of the eye were still yet unsolved in the retina, right? I still don't think we have an adequate treatment for diabetic retinopathy. So there's so much work to be done there. A lot of the other fields of ophthalmology have great technologies and innovations, but they're only making incremental gains on what's previously been done. For example, in cataract surgery, cataract surgery has been a really great surgery now for decades, and each additional lens or machine that comes out is just saving you a few seconds or a few fractions of energy put into the eye or something like that. But it's not going to be a major shift in technology.
I think there's some major shifts coming for all of us with robotics and AI in the OR, but I think that's fascinating. And how about when you meet with a when your fellows are getting ready to make the decision, your fellows are all brilliant and they're getting ready to make the decision to go into private practice or to go into academia or I guess now private equity. And then you've got this other problem in the Bay Area because once people taste the Bay Area for a couple of years, it's pretty hard to move away, but it's also pretty full. One retina specialist per eye, I guess.
For
So,
blank.
yeah. To come back to the cardiology reference at the beginning. So, how do you counsel them about what to choose? I mean, obviously, you know them. You know their proclivities and what they're like, but also you know the wonders of being in a fantastic academic setting and how great it is to be there. Not everybody can be a professor at Stanford, though. And so, how do you counsel them? What are you looking for? What are you telling them?
Well, I think we've been really, really fortunate in that we've had amazing fellows since we started this program. They have all done really, really well. And I think, we do select for fellows that most likely will end up in an academic career or at least in an academic-oriented private practice. Both you and I have very close friends that are in private practice, but they're still huge contributors and role models and key opinion leaders in the academic world. So you don't have to be at a Stanford or UCLA to make a huge impact in ophthalmology and academic ophthalmology. But I just like to give them an example of my experience. I think academics really affords a really high quality of life. We get to do really interesting things with really interesting people, and we're not killing ourselves at the same time. So it's kind of like the best of everything. Of course, we don't make as much money ultimately as someone who's out there in private practice, seeing 130 patients a day. But to me, there's trade-offs in life, and I'm willing to trade that off for the joy I get, coming to work every day. I think there's a lot of flexibility with an academic career. You can change the kind of way your week looks throughout the trajectory of your career. Maybe earlier on, you want to be more clinically active because you want to, refine your surgical techniques or your clinical decision making, and so you're going to have more days of clinic and do more surgeries. And then over time, you develop some interesting research projects or programs, and you want to spend some more effort on those, or you get more involved in medical education, a medical center leadership, medical school leadership. So there's opportunities to kind of morph your career and the way your week looks over the course of your time as an academic ophthalmologist. And I was fortunate that I had the experience of working in both settings. I worked in a private setting for a little bit in my first 5 years, and I've been working in the academic environment as well. And so I, this really spoke to me more than going and going to work and just seeing patients every day.
And so do you share that experience with them, and how does it resonate? Do they tend to gravitate towards your path, or helping them find their own path?
Well, I think, I don't often tell people what to do with their lives, but I just, give an example of what my experience has been, and hopefully that informs their decision making. And, I think whatever they ultimately choose, I'm very supportive and happy for them. I think that I want them to be happy with their choice. And if they, once they're fully informed and they have, viewpoints from, different practice types, and they think that this is the best situation for them, then I think they'll be happy. More recently, like our current class of senior fellows are both going to be taking faculty positions at an academic institution. And so, when me or one of my colleagues tells them about our experience being a professor, I think it really resonates with them and reinforces them that that's what they want to do as well. But we've also had one of our fellows who went into private practice, a really well-respected practice in the Midwest, for a number of years, and then he actually took a faculty position in South Carolina at an academic institution in the past few years. And so he was happy in both scenarios. But I think life changes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So this is a personal question, so you feel free to deflect it if you don't want to answer it. But you've got two beautiful children that are barely teenagers. I mean, there you are in the Silicon Valley. How are you and your brilliant wife raising them with relation to AI? Are you making them AI natives? Are you keeping them off all social media? I know that's two different questions, but how are you guys navigating that if it's not too personal?
Oh no, I'm happy to give my opinion because, they're free, right? So, I think it's difficult to be a parent in this generation, and we've certainly lived through those struggles about how to introduce technology to our kids. The American Academy of Pediatrics is recommending a certain thing, whether it's 13 or 16 or whatever, for phones and social media. But the reality is that, your kids are not going to be fully integrated with their peers unless they have access to some or most of these tools and apps that their peers are using. Because as much as you want to be the perfect parent, there's a lot of parents who don't care about that, and their kids are using these tools. So, I think we've taken a kind of a middle of the road approach. We don't give them free rein of everything, but over the years, we've given them more access to technology. And this was actually accelerated a little bit, but unfortunately, by COVID. We had a plan of not introducing a cell phone until a certain age, but as a two physician household, we actually were the only people on our street and probably in our neighborhood that was working outside of the house in 2020, and we just needed to be able to keep, in touch with our children. And so we had to give them phones, even though they were, I don't know, 11, 10, or whatever years old. So that was kind of forced our hand on that. With regard to AI, I think, our schools have had a really interesting approach to this. It's almost like we're going back to the dark ages. The kids aren't allowed to do any homework at home anymore. A lot of their assessments, for example, if they're writing something, is done with a pencil and a piece of paper in the classroom. They can't even type it or look at a device when they're doing these assessments. I was joking with my daughter that she's going to need a scribe, like a monk who's a scribe with a candle and, popping over her textbook for her. But the schools also realize that AI is here to stay, and so one of the schools has a policy where the kids are allowed to use AI, but they can't turn in anything that was created by AI. And I think that's kind of my personal philosophy as well with the children, because we want them to be power users of the technology, but not cheaters because of the technology. So I think if they don't use AI, they're going to get left behind. Just like there's lots of sayings out there that, doctors who can use AI are going to replace doctors who can't use AI. And I think it's the same thing in society with the younger generation. If you can use AI smartly and effectively, but it's not going to replace your brain, you're going to be more effective than someone who's not. So, I encourage them to use AI to help them with their work, but not to create their work for them.
Fascinating. And is that the consensus? I mean, I know being careful because I know you're the doctor for just about every tech CEO in Silicon Valley. So you influence how they see the world. But are you moderating your comments because someone is going to be listening to you, or is that really how you're doing it?
No, this is what I believe, but I think everything is always up for argument, right? So maybe what I believe right now is wrong, and I'll change my mind when I have a better theory. But I think we tell our kids this too, like we're just, and I'm sure you went through this with your children, we're just making it up as we go, right? There's no,
Absolutely. My
there's
kids
no
picked that up without AI. They knew that we were faking all
there,
along. Now,
we're
how are you making them super users though, Ted? How are you hoping your kids will be super users?
Well, I think, myself included, I think you just need to start using it, right? So, for example, I don't Google anything anymore, and I made that change this year. When I want to search the internet, I go on to a large language model service, whether that's ChatGPT or Perplexity or any other number of things, and I search for information using those tools. And you could argue that it gives you a better answer, a more concise answer, but I think that also has to do with what you're asking it. And when you're asking an AI for an answer, you have to be a little bit more specific and concise than if you're asking Google for an answer. I think by using a AI to find information, you're naturally just going to get better at using it. And so that's the same thing with our children. I think I'm having them use it to, create practice problems for a test that they're about to take, next week, and or
Have you
define.
seen the Perplexity education package? It's pretty interesting. They've got a customized cue card and all this stuff, question practice, question stuff. It's really actually great.
Yeah, I haven't tried it yet myself. But one of my friends was telling me about this Alpha School down in Texas. Have you heard of that? Where they go through the entire curriculum for the day in an hour or two for the kids, and then they spend the rest of the time doing, passion projects essentially. But their test scores are higher than any other school right now, and so but they're using AI to do the educational portion in that like 1 to 2 hours per day.
Yeah, fascinating. Fascinating. So, artificial teachers as well.
That's right.
But look, Ted, thank you for spending this time with us. And, our listeners around the world are so grateful to you, whether they're in China or in Japan, the rest of the Far East, all of South and Central America, Canada, Europe, Israel, the Middle East. Thank you, Ted Lang. And I encourage our listeners to reach out to Ted at Stanford and with other questions. He's an extremely friendly guy. So when you see him at meetings or coming off the podium, approach him. And Ted, thanks for taking the time with us today on Rent-A-Rounds.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you so much for having me.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.